Welcome to Buddha at the Gas Pump. Buddha at the Gas Pump is an ongoing series of interviews with spiritually awakening people. My name is Rick Archer. I've done over 500 of them now. And if this happens to be new to you, if this is your first one, and you'd like to check out previous ones, please go to batgap.com and look under the past interviews menu. This program is made possible through the support of appreciative listeners and viewers. So if you appreciate it and feel like supporting it, there's a PayPal button on every page of the website. My guest today is Humam Imami. Humam is a native of Iran, which, as you may know, is ancient Persia. His academic career has been in philosophy and religion, holism and consciousness, with earlier careers in computer science, telecommunications, and a number of educational institute startups. He just finished a master's thesis, and he's carrying on the same theme into his PhD thesis, which is on intuition, the heart faculty, and theophanies. He's going to explain to us what that is. So I have been listening to a previous interview that somebody else did with Humam, and he had what he calls a near-death experience. I'm going to ask him about that, because to me, I would define it slightly differently, but I need to learn more about it. But in any case, throughout his life, since an early age, he's been having mystical experiences and various profound breakthroughs and whatnot. And we're going to kind of trace the whole chronology of that in the course of this conversation. So let's start doing that right now, Humam. What would you like to start with? Where's the best starting point?
Oh, what's the best starting point? Well, are we allowed to make a lot of mistakes here?
Absolutely. Okay. We encourage it.
Okay. So that's a good starting point. There'll be a lot of revisions and updates. I often say that I'm a student, and a lot of this will be revised and updated very soon. Again and again.
In other words, if I were to talk to you for in a year from now, it would be a different story in many respects than it is now. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it would be a lot more. I don't know. When I look back, I started about 30 years ago. That was the near-death experience. And when I meet people in general, often I try to present a picture that isn't all about triumph and victory and celebrity status and the sort of the expectation that people have of spirituality. I try to show that it's about really being you, meaning all you, all of you. And so I usually try to, you know, I've had few opportunities, at least five that I can count, where I could have been rich, or I could have been an author, or you know, different labels, whatever labels. But I couldn't live that life, because I think my path. That's why in the best thing I could say is what some of my friends say, is that I've been a pilgrim, I've been a scholar, in the sense that I'm a student. Most of my life I've been sometimes double, triple time, full-time student. Still continue. So that's a good starting point.
Okay. And you said in your notes that, you know, after everything you've been through, you've kind of, including your NDE, you then kind of began having all these remembrances of early childhood visions, and even sort of native ancestral teachings of the East and Near East and Orient. And you sort of see it all as a part of a divine plan that really started to manifest around the age of five. Is that correct to say it that way?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that way. It goes further back as well. I mean, depends on how you look at it, because when you have an awakening, I guess a simple way to put it is that sometime around 16 and a half, when I was about to turn 17, is when the near death happened. And then that was about a 10-year trajectory of maturing, understanding, integrating the experience. And then during that time, it sort of went back as well. So it went backwards and forwards, right?
That's what you mean.
So I remembered things that happened to me at different times. And for a long time, you know, it's actually kind of ironic a bit because in terms of schooling, I couldn't really be schooled until I was about 17 years of age, until my near-death experience. So I hadn't read a single book. I got by in school, usually by memorization techniques, and with my parents' sort of connections, to put it very simply, back in Iran and in Dubai.
Why hadn't you read a book? You didn't like to read? You weren't interested in it, or what?
Yeah, that was a kind of a peculiar thing. So sometimes I think that if I was, say, in this day and age, as a young kid in the U.S., I would have probably been given some of those standard, labels for...
ADHD or something, or whatever, dyslexic, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and part of my work actually has been working with, I call them silent ones, but it sort of falls in the spectrum of autistic and especially nonverbal autistic children.
Mm-hmm.
So I seem to connect with them really well. And they communicate only, some say telepathically, I say heart to heart, at least the ones I communicate with.
You might enjoy my interview with Diane Hennessy Powell, which I did a month or so ago, and she's been specializing in working with autistic kids and autistic savants also who have these remarkable abilities.
Right. Yeah, so I go back to that subject again. If you can always bring me back on track if you like. But in terms of so when I had the near-death experience, I in retrospect, I sort of think of it as the I call it the hand of grace protected my mind, so to speak. It's like my mind was kind of locked. I mean, I literally would get severe headaches. I would feel like throwing up when I had to study. And a lot of times teachers and professors struggled to figure out what it was, and my parents struggled. And I, on the other hand, was quite a happy kid. I was a very playful child. I was very athletic. And that was my way of fitting in. Other than that, I didn't fit in at all. And the only way I did fit in was to play and play hard.
Yeah, you mentioned you were a bit of a risk taker, like climbing tall trees and things like that.
Yeah. But that kind of comes with the territory when you, in relative comparison to growing up in the West. When you see what the kids in the East do on the streets and in the way they play, they play differently than they do here in terms of safety.
You mean they're more reckless or something?
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, it kind of goes with the, I don't know. You could think of it a little more like as in, you could say maybe a little more tribal, you know, play hard, play rough. Risky,
yeah.
All of the safety regulations, a lot of them don't even exist, so you know,
over there.
But then I started learning, really my learning started with my near-death experience, and then my study started with it as well.
You might as well tell us about this near-death experience, because we've been talking about it since the beginning. People are probably curious of what happened to you.
Yeah, usually whenever people ask about these experiences, one of the things that I often say is, I don't know how others go. I mean, I've heard, I watched some of your interviews as well over the last month or so preparing. And the way that I feel about speaking of such topics is that I say that, you know, when we speak of spirituality, the word itself is spirit, and that we're spiritual beings. And so often I defer to, presence and the presence of spirit. and not so much my memory, although there is, memory is working at some level, and I don't have a problem with that either. And then it's also difficult, in a sense, for me, and that's how it's always been, to go purely by a linear trajectory. Although I can, and I'll try. But what happens is...
But you can jump around. Don't let me hold you to anything that's not natural for you.
Thank you. Well, I wanted to say that as I've been watching you, I notice how patient you are. And yeah, it's very good. Yeah, it seems like you really have your niche there in what you do.
I feel right. That, yeah. And I really enjoy it, of course. And I don't feel like I'm patient. I just enjoy it. They say a watched pot never boils, but if you're enjoying something, then you don't get impatient. You're into it, you know?
Right. The way I see it is kind of like the transparency that is inspired between us is what people will receive. And so it isn't so much that I would like to learn from you as well and ask you questions and whatnot. In fact, I was thinking about that. Then I saw your interview where your friends are asking, they're interviewing you on your show. So I watched those.
There were a few of those, yeah.
A couple of those. That was good. But yeah, as far as the near-death experience, and another side note I was noticing watching you, I would say that people that you interview, we need to listen to you as well. I noticed that. The one thing I took to heart
is... Tell my wife that.
Yeah. One thing I took to heart was I'll pay attention and listen because it's easy to, sometimes I talk to my professors in the faculty where they have 30, 40 years of experience and they'll just tell you this one sentence in a very sort of mellow, sort of passive. And if you don't catch it, it's gone, But you sort of have that way about you as well when you communicate. So if people aren't listening, they can just very quickly just...
Well, fortunately, yeah. I tend to repeat myself. So if they aren't listening the first time, maybe they'll get it the second time.
But the near-death experience, as I talk about it, it kind of feels like I have to also, in a sense, go on a vertical axis, so to speak. As I speak of it linearly, I also go this way. So the reason it is a near-death experience is I didn't know anything about near. In fact, I didn't have spiritual or religious training either before this time at all. So I had no schooling so much, not much. I had no religious or spiritual upbringing, although it does exist in my ancestry. Of course, I'm, being Persian, it was around me somewhat, and especially in my great ancestors, which we can talk about a little bit if you like, especially my great-grandfather, who was a sort of a legend for his own little town and city and place where he was. But yeah, I had no understanding of any of that, and I was too playful, really, to take notice of it. But when I had the near-death experience, I didn't call it, I didn't know what to call it for a long time. But the first thing I came away with that experience was that I encountered death. That's what I said. I said I encountered death. Then over the course of the following 10 years, as I was integrating the experience and I heard others' spiritual experiences, because I got into various spiritual paths right away, then I learned about spiritual near-death experiences. And then it was very obvious that I had gone through the stages of near-death experiences. So I wasn't clinically declared. I wasn't in an accident. There was no tragedy. I have heard of a couple of people having similar experiences, like the beloved Ramana Maharshi had something like that happen to him. But it is in the sense that I went through those stages quite dramatically in the same way that you hear near-death experiencers speak of it. And in fact, I would say that when people go through the near-death experience or this particular kind of near-death experience, which may be a very small percentage of people. In fact, I would say that in some sense, it's even more dramatic than the kind of tragic ones. And the reason for that is that it comes on through a series of, which we can talk about, a series of a confluence, let's say, of forces and of a certain temperament of the individual, a certain seeking that's happening. It comes on, and the way it was for me was it stayed on and it continued. So it didn't decrease, it didn't shut off. In fact, it was so intense that it kind of loomed in the background all the time, every day. And it continued in dream time, especially in the beginning, it continued in dream time. But it contained those stages, which near-death experiences have, to the same degree or even more intense. And when I listened to near-death experiences reports, one of the reasons that I kept quiet about it for as long as over 10 years was because of the intensity. And so I had to find the proper language. And the more I studied, the more I realized I still don't have the proper language, because others' language still didn't quite fit, although it fit to some degree in the sense of how radical, how transformative and somewhat dramatic it was. In that sense, it fit. Also, the other thing about, I think, because of just my personality, because of partly my upbringing, perhaps something to do with my constitution, my temperament, my parents, my ancestry, I have a way of keeping things very sort of even kilter, but there could be so much going on inside me. I'm one of those people where, like, I have an extremely high pain tolerance. And so it was actually quite easy for me to make it look like not much happened, whereas it was always going on. And the reason that for a long time I had to integrate it was because it was very, as I said, it was intense, but also I noticed even when I share a very tiny bit of the experience, it was already too much for people. Whereas when I hear a lot of people, and I feel that way about most of my awakening experiences, and when I say too much for people, I mean, like, let's just stay with the word too much for now.
Well, I hope I hope you'll just pull out the stops and share everything today, because I don't think it'll be too much for our audience. I think they'll appreciate it. If it's too much for them, then that's too bad.
Okay. Yeah, so the stages of near-death experience, it lasts about 4 hours. The most intense part of it was towards the end. It came on very quickly. It ended just as quickly as it began. It's started in a public space.
In a movie theater.
Right. And then there was this extreme intense cold and heat in my body at the same time as my vision was morphing.
Yeah. Your vision morphed right there in the movie theater. You had two girls, one on either side of you, who were interested in you. And the movie hadn't started yet. I know this. I totally heard this story. Yeah. And all of a sudden you were seeing all kinds of beings in the ether, as you put it, there in the theater.
Yeah, so what it looked like was, you know how you look through a microscope and the dance of molecules?
Sure, amoebas or paramecium or something like that.
Yeah. So it would come into focus and then fade out, and come into focus and fade out.
Mm-hmm. What you were seeing.
Yeah, and the intensity of it was at the same time happening in my body. So actually the intensity was more in my body than in my vision, but in my vision, that's how it started. And then the stuff I was seeing, it wasn't any phenomenon that I could make sense of. It was exactly like, more or less, like how you have a petri dish and in biology lab classes when you start to learn to look through a microscope. It kind of looked like that. It looked like just dances of atoms and molecules and sort of squiggling around, you know?
Kind of like some kind of dynamism in the atmosphere or something, some mm-hmm. subtle activity or something.
And of course, I knew nothing about Kundalini rising, awakening, or heat or cold, or I didn't know anything about any of that. But the one most striking thing about it that was very obvious was how immediate and intense it came on and stayed with me in such a way that every thought that occurred, you know, this experience of time stands still and sort of every moment gets sort of drawn out. Every thought, it's like there are no thoughts. And then when the thoughts came, they were sort of like in a state of somewhat like an awe, a state of awe. And then I would hear the thought and I would immediately hear the answer. And so when the intensity came on, the first thing was this sort of a shock and awe. But then there was an immediate calm that followed it and told me, you're fine, you're okay. I was like, wow, So it was just this continuous, wow, moment to moment to moment as it started.
Yeah, I should add here that you hadn't taken drugs or anything. You've never been inclined to do that. So this came on quite naturally.
Yeah, yeah. No, in fact, intuitively, you know, kids in high school, especially when I moved to the U.S., not so much back in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, where I also grew up before moving to the States. But here I noticed that kids often experimented and partied with, you know, marijuana. And I always felt somewhat afraid because I intuitively sensed that I was already too open. And I really stayed away. And I mean, it was around me, but it never sort of, in fact, I often helped some of the friends that had bad trips and stuff. Yeah, nothing. I didn't have any alcohol in me. Nothing. And I was very sober. As I said, I used to be very athletic. So that, on top of that, I was quite more than sober, let's say.
Yeah, you're in good shape, physically healthy.
Yeah.
Incidentally, I just want to add, the one interview that reminded me the most of your experience was one I did many years ago with Jack O'Keefe. In Ireland, she was sitting in a pub with friends in Ireland, and all of a sudden her whole perspective shifted and she saw all these beings in the room and all kinds of stuff, and she didn't know what was going on. She ran outside and it's like, oh my God. I won't go into the details, but you might want to watch that one, hear what she went through.
Yeah, that sounds like when I had my experience in Athens, Greece. I had an emergency surgery where they put me in an anesthetized state. Yeah, similar thing happened there when I came back. That experience of seeing beings all over the hospital.
But anyway, I would say to that, and this is partly why I wondered whether we should really call what you did, what you had a near-death experience, is it sounds more to me like, you know, a spiritual awakening, which came on spontaneously. And you've mentioned Kundalini, so I'm sure that was part of it and might have accounted for the physical symptoms you're experiencing, like the hot and cold and other things happening in your body. You know, there's a saying in spiritual circles, I think this is in the Bible, it says to die before you die. And in some respects, you know, spiritual breakthrough or transcendence into pure presence can be like death. Senses can withdraw from their objects and the physiology can even settle down to the point where you're not breathing. And there have been cases where people have thought that the person had actually physically died, but in fact, they had just gone into samadhi and then they eventually came out, sometimes just in the nick of time when they're on a funeral pyre or something. But it can be that radical, both physiologically and subjectively. And this whole thing about seeing stuff in the atmosphere and all that both you and Jack O'Keefe and others have experienced, there are all these subtle realms. It's, if we think of this, you know, like an ocean, most people just see the waves. But if you dive down deep, then you begin to see the fish and the other things that live in the ocean. So there are all these subtler levels of creation in which there are all kinds of things to be found if our perception is open to that.
Right. As far as calling it a near-death experience, as I said, one of the main reasons is I find that because I've had awakenings after that. I've had a number of what they call heart and kundalini and various types of awakenings. But the near-death experience and the stages of the near-death experience are quite unique in terms of, for lack of a better term, how extreme they are and how present they are in your life.
Did you have any of the typical thing where you saw deceased relatives or went through a tunnel of light or any of that stuff?
Right. And then the stages, as I was saying, so to sort of skip or fast forward, I went through the stages of, so you go through this void or vacuum. I actually feel that void and vacuum is the consciousness or the archangel of death. That's another profound aspect of this is that when you are in that presence, and another interesting thing was that when I looked up the research on this is the longer you're in that void or vacuum, this is in the research of PMH Atwater, who herself had three near-death experiences or something, and she talks about how it seems that the longer people are sort of hanging out in that void vacuum space or spaciousness, they come back with more, let's say, varieties of abilities that have awakened in them. So part of it is that aspect of it. The other is that you commune with presences that are universal and personal in such a way that you almost can't quite have that experience in that way. And that's why I think the death of the ego or die before you die is actually a statement of Prophet Muhammad. And in the Bible...
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, in the Bible, I noticed actually you interviewed a number of people that make mention of the statements of the Sufi sages and so on. And the one in the Bible is a couple of references, but one who gives his life for my sake receives new life, that it's in that context. In the context of the stories of the Prophet, his most, let's say, esteemed student, which the mystics and the Sufis often revere a great deal because from a very early age he was both tutored and raised by the Prophet, is named reverently, he's named Lord Ali. And so Lord Ali, he in fact, there's a famous story where that the companions and their families, it happened that they went to the Prophet. I don't know how frequently it happened, but this is one of the folklore stories. And they would go to him and pay their condolences that they thought Ali had died because he was in the morgue in the cemetery in the same posture position that they would put people in to be washed, to be put away. So this happened, and then when they went to pay their respects and condolences, because he was a young gentleman, and so, and then the Prophet would smile and say, "No, he's consciously dying, is what he's doing, but he's fine, you know, like be back."
So, yeah, and of course, there's so many stories of yogis going into states where they're totally gone from any kind of outer perception, and they're imperturbable. You can, you know, there's one story where somebody thinks the yogi is ignoring him, and so he gets mad and throws a dead snake around his shoulders, and the yogi just stays in samadhi. He didn't know that happened. So there are all kinds of stories like that. The senses can be that fully withdrawn from their objects as to be, you know, oblivious to the outer world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like the way I see it is dying before you die and the death of the ego. And the more mature a soul is, based on my studies, the more frequently it happens, actually, is that, you know, it's just two sides of the same token, so to speak. And when you're in that void and vacuum, which I refer to as the archangel of death, it's both a universal presence and a personalized presence, both at tandem. And it's very difficult to explain that because it feels like you are, I don't know, imagine 1,000 or 10,000 versions of the most loving parents you can ever imagine. It's that personal. Put them all together in your space, in your heart. It's that personal at the same time as it's universal. See? And so there is no other way to have that experience except in that experience of dying. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that embodiment and the death of the ego are, again, two sides of the same idea. There's a lot of talk about embodiment, but full embodiment also entails that you fully let go, or that what needs to be let go of or what needs to go is fully gone. In a sense, it's like in a very simplified example of it is, it has to be as simple as if I get in the house from cold weather and I just take my jacket off and I literally just hang it there. The more adept sages, that's precisely how they live and die. It's kind of like, given what posture or what position or what level of attainment, and I refer to this in my own writings and my own contemplations as levels of manifest presence. It's like they are consciously aware of what level of manifest presence they are in, and they just take that off and hang it and put on the other one, or there's no need to put on one and it's just off. Or
in other words, when they actually physically die, it's like just taking off a coat, because they're so established in presence already that it's not a big scary thing. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and also throughout their lives.
Yeah, throughout their lives. Actually, there are three or four different threads in what you just said that I want to have you elaborate on. Let's see if I can remember them all. The first is about the Prophet Muhammad. And wasn't it true, I don't know too much about him, but wasn't it true that he kind of got his start, so to speak, when he was completely zapped by some angels or something and just went through this life-altering experience one night? Isn't that the story?
Yeah, so the stories of the life of the Prophet is told in a number of ways. They're the more traditional, they're the more esoteric, but I think generally it's agreed that sometime around the age of 40, he had this profound encounter with the Archangel Gabriel in the cave, where he would go frequently and meditate. But the stories are told by Abu Bakr, who was very close to him. He actually started to go into retreat as early as when he was 12 years of age.
Oh, okay. So he had that inclination. So,
yeah, he frequently retired into, and there were particular sects of the Arab tribes that were descendants of Abraham. They were in the minority, and they were believers of the one God. You know, and so the Prophet, a little bit like the story of Buddha and others, the Prophet was very much inquisitive and wanted to discover for himself what that was about. And then he also, there's a number of references to, you know, like one of the things it's said about him, it's often mentioned in the teachings of the Sufi sages, is that he died there's different numbers, but they say sometimes 70 times a week he died.
Or, yeah, I think we need to find a better word than died, you know, because I'm sure his heart didn't stop, or even if it did, it wasn't that kind of death. It was more of like a transcendence or a samadhi kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, like, one of the themes of my life was, after my awakenings from, say, about 16 and a half, for 10 years, I was pretty confused and trying to integrate the whole thing. And then I was just hitting puberty and getting lost in, you know, trying to make a living. And I got married young once, and I modeled for a couple of years, and I was an athlete, and I was just really sort of all over the place. And trying to integrate this, and but I was so intensely into a spirituality at the same time that it was quite confusing, actually, how to integrate all this. So that went on for some time, about 10 years. But then sometime around 2002 to 2005, I had the next biggest transition of my life, which was another awakening that was like the near-death experience, but it was 10,000 times more intense, is how I put it.
Before we get to that, I want to wrap up a couple more threads, and then we'll come right to that. I was hearing in one of your other interview that you experienced incredible vastness during this initial breakthrough you had, and the vastness was frightening because it was so vast, or perhaps because there was a dissolution of your individuality in that vastness or something. Could you just elaborate on that for a bit?
Yeah, so actually that's what I was kind of referring to as well. In the same context that when I, after the awakenings, I had encounters. This is why one of the subjects I think that perhaps theophanies is the word literally from theos and phani, which means encounter, and then divinity or divine encounters or divine flashes, divine encounters. When you start to have those types of awakenings that happen in the near-death experience and beyond, if anyone had told me the kinds of things that are possible, I wouldn't have believed it unless I had those experiences. So it goes along with that basically, you know, the saying, there's nothing impossible with God and things like that of that nature, is there was just no end to the surprise, because once in 2002 to 2005, once the next phase started for me, I was completely sort of stripped of my intellectual, all forms of intellectual training, because by then I had now 12, 13 years of learning and awakening, and I was sort of integrating all this. And then when that broke open and when that sort of started to strip as I became a pilgrim, I realized that there is really no limit to what's possible. So talk about vastness, talk about, I mean, all kinds of extreme stuff that we could talk about, but usually I'm sort of reluctant because then it, you know.
This is your opportunity, and I think we can handle it.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, for instance, the savants and the silent ones and the stories you hear in books, a series of books like Masters of the Far East and, you know, resurrection powers and dematerializations and bilocations and the stories you hear in the classic texts of the Sufis, and you hear them also especially of the female saints as well. Teresa of Avila in the Christian tradition, in the Muslim tradition, Rabia and Fatima and, you know, the prophet's wife and on and on. You hear all these really, really extreme stories where they're told like they're legends, like they're part of the folklore, mythic culture. That's how they're told. And you kind of grow up, and I remember growing up in Iran, you know, when you're immersed in it and it's all around you in your culture, you take for granted, and you almost, especially the younger generation, they kind of mock it as well. They're kind of like, they're trying to modernize. That's one of the, what I refer to as the curses of the sort of modernism, so to speak, is this alienation from the roots, you know, especially indigenous cultures have this affliction, so to speak. But what happens is when you go through certain levels of awakening, you start to see that those things are realities. Like the Sufi sage Ibn Arabi, for instance, in one of his pilgrimages, Ibn Arabi is one of sort of the greatest Muslim philosopher mystics. And he's a very unique fellow. I don't know how he managed to do this, but he was in the presence of some over 100 of the greatest saints that ever lived in his own time. So he had a way of finding them, as well as having travels and journeys with the great prophets from beyond the veil. So he's quite an interesting character in the history of the Muslim literature. And so in one of his contemplations, he's contemplating over the life of Christ. And he refers to Christ as his first teacher, in fact. And he was quite a rebel, and then Christ appeared to him as a teenager, and his path started. But for instance, things like he speaks of being on a pilgrimage, and he's contemplating this statement that Christ said, you know, if you have the faith, as little faith as a mustard seed, you say to the mountain, move, and it shall move. And in his contemplation, he's drawing on the meaning of the statement. And at that very instant, Christ appears next to him and says to him, no, I meant it literally. And then he's somewhat awestruck, and he starts to contemplate that. And then, of course, he can hold space for that, right? Although otherwise that wouldn't have happened in that way. And so then Christ, seeing that, says to him, why don't you do it now? Tell the mountain to move. And so he says to the mountain, move. And then, of course, he's shocked to find that the mountain physically moves. So then he goes, this is like one of his discoveries that he's having along his pilgrimages. There are many stories like that in all traditions. And we tell them like they're sort of like mythic in legend. But then if you sort of look deeper, there's really no limit to what can happen given the state, given the proper conditions, the proper state of being that person, I often refer to it as the way in which we host presence.
Okay, now, as you told that story, I'm sure many people, and myself included, thought, all right, well, this is an old story from 1,000 years ago or something. and who knows if the mountain actually moved and what that actually really means. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, as they say. So, I mean, the reason you brought this up is that you said that in your own experience, it had been such a dramatic breakthrough that things started to happen that you are reluctant to talk about because people wouldn't believe them. So how about bringing it up to the present? You know, what sort of things are you referring to? What sort of things have happened to you?
Sure. So when you speak of vastness, for instance, or my talk of vastness and the varieties of the types of things that are possible, as I said, with the Archangel of Death and so on, it needs to be put into a context where the right, again, I'm going to come at it in a sort of a vertical way again, it's contextualized correctly and then very delicately walked out, this kind of talk or this kind of subject. It's easy to say X, Y, and Z happened. But as you said, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proofs. And then the question is, for whom and why? In other words, who is listening and who's speaking to ask that question? So it's a very delicate line. In other words, you know, like one thing I kind of like about Ludwig Wittgenstein, who overthrew more or less modern philosophy. He's like the sort of at the cusp of modern to postmodern. He's like more or less one of the, we could say, fathers of postmodernism. Is that his most difficult work, actually, the Tractatus is what it's called, is about trying to say the unsayable. You know, so I think that a lot of spiritual stuff that we speak about or we speak of, they're not really, how should we say it? I mean, there's many ways to say it, but to get at this, but it's a delicate and somewhat complex subject, but it needs to be addressed. There are levels at which it needs to be addressed properly, right? It's very easy to say, yeah, X, Y, and Z happened, but then why should we like talk about personal experiences in that context, you know, for the whole world to hear, okay, now who man can do this or that, this or that happened to him?
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy and discussion around that. I mean, Patanjali devoted one chapter before chapter book to explaining siddhis and how to perform them. But then most people say, well, you're not supposed to do them. They're just a distraction. But then it was like, you know, why did he spend so much time talking about them? And then there's, you know, all kinds of stories. If you read Yogananda and other books about yogis performing remarkable things, and of course, all the things Jesus did and everything. But then a lot of teachers say, well, you know, that's a distraction. You shouldn't do it. So I guess what you're saying is, if it's meant to happen, it'll happen. If you're meant to be able to do it, you'll be able to do it. And sometimes there might be a good reason for being demonstrative about it and letting others see. It might like really shake them up. And other times, maybe there wouldn't be, and you should just be discreet. It depends on so many factors. Obviously, it depends on who's watching, and it depends on who's performing. If they have ego left, it could end up aggrandizing it and making them think they're pretty cool and you know, being a real, it could be a real trap for them.
Yeah. I mean, you just touched on exactly like the many angles to that subject. Yeah. I guess one thing we could say is what can be demonstrated within a reasonable time, let's say, is to demonstrate the possibility of something like this within reason by the clarity, again, it's in the way we host presence. So it's in the clarity of the expression itself. So the demonstration is like, for instance, I could say these things have happened to me and continue to happen to me. And then you could say, or someone could say, well, what do you mean? So then I defer to, usually this is what I do. I mean, this is naturally what happens in the way it comes, is I defer to the clarity of the expression in the experiences of the great ones. And then I also usually, by paying attention, find that in the moment, for instance, before our interview, there's these little seedlings of different elements coming in. And then at the time of the interview or at the time I'm having a conversation with someone, this is a little bit more delicate in the sense that it's a very wide audience.
Yes. Many different levels of understanding and experience. Yes.
Yeah. I often think of, sometimes my friends say they see me on a Persian carpet in their dreams. I've heard this a few different times. So sounds like Aladdin, you know?
Well, you know the way I deal with wide audiences, and I used to teach meditation and I had this in mind, which is that I would swing across the spectrum and swing back and swing across the spectrum and swing back. In other words, I'd kind of move to address, you know, really fundamental nitty gritty points and then more profound points and then really awesome points, you know, that many people wouldn't appreciate, and then swing back again. And it's just kind of like, you know, right. like a machine gun strafing the audience. And you catch people all along that spectrum. And so it keeps them engaged. And then they go away probably forgetting the stuff that didn't pertain to them and remembering the point which actually hit them where they are.
Exactly. So we're right on each other's heels. Because I was going to say, a Persian carpet and carpet weavers, I like the expression of a loom. A loom is kind of hanging. That's exactly how they weave the Persian carpet.
Going back and forth, yeah.
Exactly. And then you have all these colors. And they say some of these Persian carpets take as many as more than a lifetime of a carpet weave.
Isfahan, right? That's the big carpet place in Iran.
And that's where I grew up, actually.
Isfahan. Oh, really? Okay.
I was born in Ahvaz. I grew up in Isfahan.
Nice.
So yeah, exactly what you said is what I'm sort of trying to express here, is that the wider the audience, the more multi-textured, multicolored is this loom. And then there is this sort of movement, and then there's this sort of movement happening. Yeah. So I say the demonstration needs to be given in the most reasonable sort of sense. And here it needs to be general enough. So I would say, for instance, television shows often get the highest viewings, from what I've found, are those on miracles, for instance.
Sure, people are fascinated with that kind of thing.
Exactly. So if people can envision, because people have an easier time accepting the most bizarre stories when they're tragic, right? Like, grandma prayed, I was somewhere else, I fell off a cliff, but somehow some force picked me up and put me back. Like, you know, and then that's acceptable because it was just so tragic. But if you think about it, I mean, that is like the kind of story you read in the classic folklore legend textbooks about the saints and the sages and the prophets. And there is stories of disappearances and reappearances in these miracles. There's stories of what they call creative miracles, where organs that aren't there appear in a person's body, and then they go to the doctor, and the doctor says, okay, for some reason, our records show that your gallbladder was taken out 10 years ago, but it was just a fluke. It was a mistake. You have a beautiful brand new gallbladder. And the person says, I swear you guys took out my gallbladder. And the doctor say, no, no, no. So we're okay with accepting all sorts of really bizarre stuff when it's in tragic circumstances. So if you can just allow for that, then in ordinary circumstances, right, it can happen too.
Sure. Well, you know, I think maybe one of the reasons these kinds of TV shows are popular and is that people realize that there's more to life than what they experience. For most people, life is fairly mundane, but they just have this intuitive sense that there is so much more and I'm not experiencing it. So, you know, TV shows or books or movies or like, you know, there's been some wonderful movies made by Steven Spielberg and different people like that. They inspire people because it touches something that they know is possible and they want to know more. It inspires them.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, so I have had experiences like that. I'll tell you one of them. I think this would suffice for here.
Okay.
At one time, see, this is why I keep going back to something I often refer to as, so levels of manifest presence, and then also the subject of the unlearned innocence of the heart. You know, often we talk in mental hypothetical terms, and it's sort of up here. So I call it a mind-brain orientation. But I think we need to really tune into a heart-mind orientation. Even as we listen or as we speak or whatnot, in terms of the way that we vertically host presence. And so one of the great beings that I admire very much is a Christian mystic sage named Bruno Gröning. He sort of came into my life at a very critical time. When he lived, he was also a master healer of a proportion that people say they haven't seen since, and they hadn't seen since Christ. And he lived 1906 to 1959. And in the particular way that he made himself present and available to the masses was really incredible, because there are beings who are quite powerful and we hear about them, all the legends and the powers and so on. But in his case, for whatever reason, the divine dispensation that was bestowed through him was to serve the masses. And so these extremely, extremely profound miracles happened through him.
Where was he, in Germany or someplace?
Yeah, he was from Gdansk in 1906 to 1959. It went back and forth between being parts of Poland and Germany. Now it is Germany. He had these incredible abilities as early as he could walk or talk. And he lived through both world wars. And I often think that it's quite an interesting phenomenon that he lived at the same time throughout the same era as Hitler did. And so we know which one people listen to more. So these are all interesting ironies there. But he came into my life. There's several independent friends that sort of follow and learn his teachings. And there's one very large group of friends that's more organized around the globe in over 100 countries. So it's actually the largest nonprofit humanitarian-based voluntary. So it's everything is freely given. All the volunteers also freely serve in over 100 countries. So it's the largest spiritual healing organization. But I came across him at one time, and a lot of healing started to happen for me physically. And
in other words, your own problems were being healed?
Yeah, physical.
I see.
Because mm-hmm. One thing that's very unique about him, the other person that I have encountered who is a living person with whom people report similar things is a fellow named Brazzo.
Oh, yeah. He gazes. I'm aware of Brazzo.
Yeah. So Brazzo and the Brazzo family are kind of friends too. And I've known them since they came to the States. And if I throw out big names, I should say this. It's a very personal journey for me, and it's very much a journey of with God, in God, and it's not about a person or persons around them. For me, it's very much the walk of a pilgrim, so to speak, you know, like the teaching of Christ, be a passerby in the world, not of the world, that kind of attitude. So I speak of them not so much in terms of worshiping them or idolizing them, but more like brothers on the path or sisters on the path. One of the phenomena that started to happen was that I learned that this can be transmitted or can be given, or there's different ways to put it. It was quite alarming, quite shocking in a sense that then people started to come to me and say, you know, this is like the presence of the Holy Spirit. These are certain. Then, I mean, I knew this, but not at this level of manifest physical sort of presence. And then I had a number of experiences where I was shown that if I still doubted that this is possible, go ahead and demonstrate it. So I said to myself, so these things happen in my communions with spirit. So this happened in my communions with spirit, my meditations and so on. When I say that, so I had these experiences, and then in these communions, I was also shown that, hey, you know, I do have a bit of a sort of a, I kind of think of it as a mystic scientist sort of way of thinking about things. That if I still have any doubt, go ahead and demonstrate it. Because it was unbelievable, some of the stuff that I was experiencing in my body and around me. And I thought, okay, how do I do this? Now, if I want to demonstrate this, this is going to like raise a lot of eyebrows. It's going to get a lot of attention really fast. besides, I don't really believe I can do this anyways, but just let's just say this is how I am with myself. Like, let's just say that some of this stuff can happen. So let's see. So usually what I do is I have a couple of close friends and I call them up. I say, and they know me, so they're like, they're always up to it. You know, they're like, oh, you're up to something new? Yeah, I'm in. What do you want to try? You know, so I'm like, okay, you know, my spiritual brother, I say, hey, can we do this? Can we try this? He goes, okay. So I even usually a lot of times I'm just so excited, I pull over right on the phone. I'll say, okay, let's try this or something. And then I thought, okay, and this has happened several times on my journey, in my pilgrimages. And I thought, also now let's see if I could just be with my friends or two or three friends. And I usually ask the divine and it just happens. Like I don't need to organize it. So we'll be at a cafe or that very day, two people will be, I don't know, on campus or something. And they'll ask me, oh, really? For real? This is possible? And I'll say, yeah. And let's sit. Let's try this or something. So this grew within a short time to where I said, okay, let me now try it. And it all felt right. It all felt good. Let me now try sitting with three, four, five people. And the phenomenon that started to manifest was quite profound. So for instance, in some cases, a person in more than one case, and then I had to remember that this has happened prior as well, a person would go into complete catharsis, like literally die and come back. This was one of the things that would happen. And then it got to a point where I was actually scared of approaching a person with this energy because I noticed that the moment I intended it, it happened. So I didn't need to touch. I didn't need to. So then it just kind of grew in proportion and it was kind of scary in a way because it was given to me and it was said to me, you want to demonstrate it and you want to test it to see how real it is? Go ahead. You know, and I was like, really? And I couldn't almost believe it. And then here I was testing it and it was happening. And I was like, okay. And then it drew the attention of a lot of old timers. Sometimes they call them spiritual veterans. So I was in some famous spiritual places, like some of these spiritual hubs. And all of a sudden, these people that like live out in the mountains and stuff started coming out. People that don't go to any event or any person. In places like Sedona, I lived in Sedona, Mount Shasta. I didn't live there. So these folks came out. And then they wanted to watch and observe. This is very small still, just a few friends. After about the third or fourth time this happened, and at the same time, I realized the most extreme kind of darkness also comes up against it. So the most extreme light types of things happen, and the most extreme type of darkness. And this had been a theme in my journey of self-acceptance, which we can get into. It's a very important theme, actually, because I had a harder time with the shadow side, obviously. And then one day I was sitting outside after one of these little gatherings. I just called them prayer circles, satsang. I usually didn't call it anything. I just said, tell your friends, and then that's how it was. I was just, let's just sit and talk. And then once it happened to one or two people, then it just sort of spiraled and then they brought others.
And just to remind us, so what happened to these one or two people was they would go into an altered state or samadhi or shift in consciousness or something, right?
Yeah. And physical phenomenon would manifest in their body that would leave their body, healings, things like that.
Okay. Physical changes would take place.
Yeah. The manifest presence of spirits and spiritual forces showing up on pictures, even things like that. And as I said, because of the level of intensity, at one point, I even received guidance, don't get close and don't touch anymore.
Guidance from?
Just in my own communions.
I see, your own intuitive inner guidance.
Yes.
So in other words, you dabbled with this stuff, but whoever is overseeing your life thought, okay, that's enough. You know, you've had a taste of this, but don't get carried away with it.
Yeah, but I want to tell you one important thing to wrap it up with is I was sitting outside in one of the last ones and I was looking at the stars, at the sky. A lot of phenomenon happens with me and around me often in my life. And I feel that's important. This physical phenomenon, one of the most beautiful things I learned from Bruno Gröning's teachings was No one had ever said it that simply. He said, you don't have to prove to me God's existence or powers or whatever. You're responsible to prove it yourself. Yeah, and no one had said it that simply, that beautifully. Ever since I got that from him, I was like, wow. So it's kind of like we excuse, it's like we're not worthy. We believe in miracles, but only in tragic circumstances. Or it's like, yeah, we could pray whatever, however many times or hours, meditate and pray. But no, you know, the big stuff is reserved for the saints. You know, we can't manifest miracles. We can't have these supersensory abilities or whatever. So I think we kind of play false humility a lot. Whereas actually the great ones want for us to actually have the greatest awakening possible all the time, including the abilities and whatnot.
I think a lot of it has to do with what the cultural norm is. In this day and age, all the you say things like that and it just seems far-fetched and out of place with our contemporary world. But 150 years ago, if you talked about airplanes and computers, that would seem far-fetched and out of place with the contemporary world. It seemed like you're just indulging in fantasies, but now we just take that stuff for granted. There could easily be a society, who knows when, where the kinds of things you're alluding to and you're even hesitant to talk about in very great detail are just, you know, you mention it and somebody say, so what? That's been around me all my life. Everybody does that. What are you making a big deal of it? You know, it's a matter of what we're accustomed to.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, in indigenous cultures, for instance, the one class I taught completely was a class that was called Great Thinkers East and West. And I started the class with the indigenous cultures. And especially I showed the documentary of named Aluna of the Kogi. The Kogi are a very unique tribal people. They're the only remnants of what an ancient tribe would look like if they had been left alone and untouched. They live at some 20,000 feet elevation. They're the only tribe also that can sustain a survival at that altitude. They live in the Sierra Nevada mountains of Colombia. And there is a couple of documentaries. Twice they allowed BBC to go there and give their messages to the world. And then there are a lot of sort of New Age authors and others that talk about them as well. But they have a lot of abilities. Their elders know of the birth of a child before the child comes into the world in terms of the destiny of the child to be trained as a spiritual leader. And then for the first 9 years, the child is actually trained in a pitch black dark cave with only the mother and a spiritual elder and the parents being able to visit the child. And then after 9 years, the child emerges from the cave. It's just unimaginable what sort of powers and abilities now this child has cultivated, because before the sensory organs have opened to the outside world, all that's like brewing inside is what came with the child from spirit.
According to our contemporary understanding, that would completely destroy a person's life. They would be totally stunted in so many different ways. But yeah. Apparently the Kogi can do it. Another thought that popped into my head as you were speaking was that it's similar to what I just said, which is that, you know, if it's true that we only use a small fraction of our full potential, then the society, the world we see around us is a reflection of the fact that pretty much everybody only uses a small fraction of their full potential. But if using 50% or 90% or 100% were the norm, imagine how different the world would be.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing about that, another classic that I like, classic literature in terms of the people that are in spiritual healing world, it's actually a very simple read, but it's very powerful because of the presence of the kahuna, native indigenous culture of the Hawaii and Hawaiian people, is called Zero Limits. It's actually a book written by Joe Vitale. It's about the story of a psychologist. So he has his sort of medical background as well, but he's also a native indigenous Hawaiian. And that's an interesting book. You must have heard of the Ho'oponopono prayer, the I love you, forgive me, thank you, please, and that sort of. But what's more important is, his name is Dr. Hugh Lin. In this book, Dr. Hugh Lin, the presence he hosts and the presence he holds in terms of the level of forgiveness and love that he talks about and he can practice and exercise, it's quite profound. And one of the things that he talks about, which is interesting, it's sort of a paradigm that we've moved into with postmodernism and the new sciences and so on. And I like to highlight it in this way. Now we sort of know that we take in about 240, 50 billion bits of information per second, of data per second coming in. So 240, 50 billion bits, they used to say 20 million, now it's 240 billion. So it tells you that the more sensitive our equipments get, it seems we actually are capable of even more than we thought.
Yeah, it's like the number of stars in the galaxy or galaxies in the universe. They keep upping the number.
Right. So now it's 250 billion bits per second is coming in at all times. In terms of how much we process, it's very little. But the question is this: what's happening to 240 billion bits? Because we know it's coming in, right? Likewise, we could say this about some spiritual healers talk about 500 billion, I think. Is it billion or million cells, brand new cells a day come in? But because so much of it is immediately programmed with our preconceived conditioning and the repetition, the repertoires that we have, so the brand new cell is immediately conditioned again to the old pattern. Or the 240 billion bits of information per second, what makes it even a little bit wilder and crazier is that the scientists at HeartMath Institute, this is another famous paradigm people talk about. So that's the brain, 240 billion bits per second. The heart is 1,000 times electrically and 5,000 times magnetically more powerful and expansive than the brain. So now you have 240 billion bits happening through a trillion neurons in the brain, but you have this at the heart level, 1,000 to 5,000 times more than that happening. That's in the now. So it's like, yes, we utilize only 5% of this or 10% of that, but that's because on a linear trajectory with limited equipments, we confine it to that. Whereas even those limited equipments are telling us, look at how much is coming in.
So the name of the game is upgrade the equipment. Not get new equipment, but unfold the full capacity of the equipment you have.
Right. Yeah.
All the spiritual practices are supposed to do.
How that's important is like this. When we talk about these really wild and crazy awakenings that we think we're not worthy of for that, whatever, only in tragic circumstances is acceptable. That's what happens. I mean, when you have decades and hundreds and thousands of years of now recorded and documented varieties of really crazy things, it's like this whole full spectrum of anything imaginable can happen. So you say, you can imagine in that instant, let's say a grandmother's prayer, and these are also personal experiences often when I say grandmother, I'm talking about my grandmother's. A grandmother's experience, you know, a prayer over way across the other side of the globe and a kid over there falling off a cliff gets pulled back up. I mean, what power, what senses, what part of what is working? And I don't think it should be necessarily verbalized either. It's a level of the innocent, unlearned innocence of the hearts of these types of people like the Kogi. They just so readily accept that this switching happens between different realms and realities instantly.
Rupert Sheldrake has done a lot of nice research on this. You know Rupert?
Yeah.
He's been on Bad Cap.
I actually watched young Rupert's dialogues with Krishnamurti.
Oh, cool. Yeah,
way back. He's earlier.
There's also a guy named Mark Gober who wrote a book called The End to Upside Down Thinking, and he kind of summarizes all this different kind of thing of various anomalies, you know, that challenge the scientific assumption, some materialistic assumption that consciousness is merely a product of the brain, then the universe is meaningless, and when we die, that's the end of it, and all kinds of stuff kind of predominant in our culture. I have a few questions I could ask you, both in my own head and from people who sent them in, but I don't want to derail you if you were about to say something that you wanted to say.
No, that's fine. We're good. Let me just close it with this. So when I was sitting outside after these series of things happened, this is important, I think, for a variety of reasons. And I was sort of looking at the stars and I was thinking about this and I was thinking these phenomena. What is going on? What is happening? One thing that came to me in that instant was, this can get a lot of attention really fast. And I was like,
Do you want that?
Exactly. And the immediate answer was just very obvious. There was no second thought, no. And then there was this ching in the whole cosmos. Good, you got it. You know,
boy.
Yeah. I was like, oh, okay. And then actually, after that, I was told how it could be made even more powerful without me getting any attention. So I thought, you know, hallelujah, thank you, God, you know, or however you say it. So these things can happen and do happen and frequently happen. And we sometimes just aren't tuned in, you know. It's like a lot of times in my close friendships and companionships over the years, the good stuff, you know, there's a lot of mess and mistakes that we have made and stuff. Although luckily I have never tried to do anything big and I don't think I ever will. But just in my friendships, that subject's come up a lot. A lot of things can happen, really powerful things happen. At the same time, it's a very delicate balance.
Yeah, that's a good point. There have been people who have done all kinds of flashy things around whom there's also been a great deal of controversy. And, you know, some of them have even ended up in jail because their life was so unethical in other dimensions. So all this stuff is interesting, but it's a very delicate path if one is personally involved in, or, you know, treading that path. Perhaps it does lend some support to the notion that these things can become a stumbling block or an obstacle on one's journey. Your attitude toward them sounds very healthy, actually. You're reluctant to even talk about them. If we assume that you can do all the sorts of things that you're vaguely alluding to, then, you know, what if you were to do them? It would be a whole different life for you. And what would it do for you? It might help some people. It might inspire some people. It might blow their minds. But where would you end up in your personal journey, which, you know, you could end up on some kind of ego trip or something. I don't know you that well, but, you know, it could be a huge downfall for you. So it sounds like you're being very prudent and careful. And safety first is always a good motto on the spiritual path.
Yeah, I would just say that they happen. And, you know, there's also some East-West or ancient-modern types of discernments that need to be in place, because on some level, I'm okay with what's new and what's in and what's hyped and what's new age. And, you know, I hear you also address that neo-Vedanta or neo-this or neo-that. Because we have a lot of it. We have neo-Christians and neo-Muslims. And that's okay because that's part of the culture as well. And it's part of the progress that every new generation needs to somehow adapt and bring in the new and the hope of the future and that sort of thing. Those types of discernments need to be in place in terms of discerning spirits, discerning spiritual forces, discerning the kinds of temperaments and attitudes we need to have. On the one hand, it's actually necessary to have these experiences and have them more often to have the right discernment. On the other hand, if you overemphasize the phenomenon, this is why I say delicate balance, because we also have this false humility thing where we cop out, where we say, oh no, you know, nothing has to happen. I just meditate for like, what, 10 years, whatever, however many hours. And then it's like, well, what's happening? You know, it's like, well, I just feel better. Well, that's, I mean, come on, like a lot more can happen for you, you know? So that delicate balance, and that delicate balance is also the understanding of cultures. Like when you talk about healers, teachers, leaders, a lot of the neo types are the do-it-yourselves.
Yeah.
I often say that ruthless and ruthless kind of go together.
What were ruthless, the two words? Ruthless and ruthless. What?
Ruthless.
And?
Root, as in the root of a tree.
Like a tree without roots, and ruthless. Yeah. In other words, if the person is rootless, if they're not anchored deep, then they can be ruthless.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's the ancestry. That's the culture. So you need to have the discernment on many levels. So this delicate balance is on many levels.
It's really an important point, and it's kind of a subtle point, but there's so many concrete examples of it that aren't subtle. It almost seems that almost every famous teacher, not all, but so many, have turned out to be corrupt in some way. Maybe they actually provided some valuable teachings and were inspiring and, you know, uplifted a lot of people. But then whole batches of people get disillusioned because it turns out that behind the scenes they were doing this, that, and the other thing. So it really seems that if you could prioritize the various qualities you want to develop, I would say discernment might want to be number one, because it safeguards the others. It kind of keeps everything in balance and in proportion and prevents you from getting out on a limb and getting carried away in one particular area while neglecting something so important that it's going to completely trip you up at some point and do a lot of harm and earn yourself who knows what kind of karma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the advice to each their own. I hear that the beloved Ramana Maharshi used to often say that when they asked him about gurus. He said to each their own. I think that goes a long ways, because another way I put it is supply meets demand.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know, so...
people get what they deserve.
Right. Something along those lines. You know, people need the lessons they need. And sometimes they're hard lessons, and the teachers, you know, whether they're teachers or charlatans or what they are. And
yeah, it's true. But if we want to bring it back to ourselves, then, you know, you think, do I want to be the kind of teacher who is having all these clandestine sexual affairs or getting drunk all the time or something? Is that what really I want my function to be? Or would I rather be someone who is completely in integrity, even if I have little or no following? You know, maybe nobody knows about me, but at least I know that within myself, everything is clean.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I would say that most of what we call in the hyped up, sort of overstimulating, over-sensationalized culture and new cultures and this sort of thing, when we say things like teacher, to me, I'm just going to say my experience, because the most important thing in my awakening, in fact, often I go back again to this unlearned innocence of the heart. The precursor to every great awakening is when you are most you and just as simple as you are, not the perfect you, not in your best behavior. It's just when you're sitting there, you know, what is the best prayer is when you, after the fact, find out, oh man, I just prayed for that like 5 years ago or something, and that was quite a profound prayer. And then you kind of think back, well, how did I do that? Because I just got like a near-death experience as an answer to that prayer. You know, it's like the most awakened and awakening moments of our lives almost happen without us even knowing it.
Innocently.
You know, yeah.
Except you be as little children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven.
Right. So I often defer back to the time I didn't know much at all. And then after knowing a few things and 10, 13 years of more awakenings, then getting stripped again completely, that other experience of 10 to 10,000 times more intense than the near-death experience, and then becoming a pilgrim for some 15 years. And then again, I nearly drowned once and I had an emergency surgery and so many things happened. You know, with women, with men, with movements, global movements, it was just this crazy ride. And it calmed down after 3 to 5 years. But with all of that, as far as teachers are concerned, from my personal experience, although I love and respect everybody on the spiritual path, I haven't really burnt any bridges. I don't really have any enemies. But despite all that, when I defer back to the precursor for the greatest awakening moments that I've had, I would say that more than 90% of what we dub as teachers haven't even been students yet.
Many haven't. I don't know about the percentage. I mean, many of the people I interview who are teachers have been students, and some of them still are. They'll go and sit with another teacher or go to a therapist, or, you know, they're kind of continually upping their game by getting feedback from peers and people whom they respect. But, you know, it's a good point, because if one has never actually been a student, I can think of one young teacher who's very popular, who's never really had a teacher and was too impatient to have a teacher. He would go to a teacher and think, I already know this stuff. I don't need to do it. I can just get it all on my own. And, you know, he's a very controversial figure, because it's all about him, and there's a lot of narcissism and so on. He's never sort of cultured that humility that working with a qualified teacher could bring.
Right. And then, of course, going deeper, it begs the question, what is a student? What is a teacher?
One thing I want to loop back to towards the beginning of our conversation, you were talking about, you know, near death, or you're talking about advanced souls who were so established in presence that, you know, they could slough off this body like hanging a coat on the hook. And you also talked about integration. And so the question came in my mind that, in a way, and maybe this is characteristic of your experience even now, after all you've been through, is there a sense in your experience that this near-death thing, which happened 37 years ago or something, where you seem to go off into another world, that has integrated to the point where you're there, you're in that world now, even though you're talking to me and driving your car and eating lunch and doing regular stuff, but there's a dimension of nothing happening, you're gone, the word dead isn't good because it has so many connotations, but you don't exist, you could say. And at the same time, there are other levels at which you do exist and you are doing things. And so it becomes this sort of integrated multi-dimensional thing rather than either or.
Yeah. And it, you know, this is where I often get into what I call the journey of one's self-acceptance. I think it still is, and it was, and perhaps will be, one of the most challenging aspects of my life since my birth, because in some ways I was always either outcasted or stood out like a sore thumb, or there was always something that sort of kept me as a minority of minorities, you know, already as a family of immigrants. People can't imagine, most people don't really understand what it's like to go from the East to the West and then relocate 2-3 times and try and adapt. And especially at the age where I was, in fact, one of the catalysts to the near-death experience was my relocation to the U.S. and the culture shock. There was other elements too. I think the core of it was what I again refer to as the unlearned innocence of the heart, which is just the being, at some level, the being who I am, is more present and engaged.
So it's more present than engaged. In other words, tell me if this is what you mean. You appear to be doing things. You're speaking to me. You're riding a bicycle. You're doing whatever you do. But the being which you are is not doing those things. It's just presence, which doesn't ride bicycles or speak or eat. Or, you know, it's kind of just, its nature is being. It bees.
Yeah, so integration has happened at different levels of my own self-acceptance and my own honesty, boldness. Boldness is quite something to cultivate too. Boldness with oneself to start with. You know, I often say even some of the very basic teachings of the great sages, like repentance, for instance. This beginning teaching of, you know, the Buddha or Christ, where they talk about sin as in missing the mark, or dukkha in the Buddhist tradition has some similar meanings, where they talk about some of the root meaning of the words, of trying to sort of get at the root of the source of your suffering, and then getting to a point of a turnaround, so to speak. A lot of the great teachers, especially in the more ancient traditions, they first talk about this dance of duality. You get a lot of that, especially in the earlier, like my native ancestors who were Zoroastrian. So, you know, I often say if the non-dual people, if they don't understand the duality, they don't understand non-duality usually. Because they're
point.
Sort of trying to... So it's like this coming into an awareness of the shadow. And all of the great sages, all the great prophets, especially the more serious, let's say, the great traditions, man and woman, they don't kid around with this subject of heaven and hell or light or darkness. And it doesn't matter which one you look at. And the level of simplicity and boldness you need to have to understand, to put it very boldly now that we're saying this, how full of BS you are at the same time as you're this great angel. But that having that moment to moment, the great sage Ibn Arabi, he talks about this in terms of the transcendence is God's incomparability. And then the immanence is God's similarity. And he says that the greatest sages have cultivated such level of surrender, submission, and innocence that at every instant, they're in a state that he calls Hova La Hova. And you've heard that sound of who is a very sacred sound in the Sufi traditions. Some Americans have heard them say hu, but it's actually who. It's also the sound of the breath and the heart. And so Hova La Hova means he, not he, but not so much in the masculine or feminine sense, but the sacred. So at every instant, awareness itself is affirming and negating. He, not he, he, not he. And he says those are the highest states of cognition, where the immanent and the transcendent are in a constant sort of perfect, constant, harmonious dance. You're not he, you're he. You're not he, you're he. You're not he, you're he. So it's like, and then he brings that down to the level of the heart, actually. He says that the heart, because in the Abrahamic languages, Aramaic, Arabic, Farsi, qalb, comes from the word taghallub, which means to fluctuate. And the fluctuation, the contraction and expansion of the heart, he likens the contraction and the expansion to this incomparability and similarity. And he also likens the one to the eye of reason and the other to the eye of creativity, or what they call creative imagination, or the imaginal world, the transcendent world. So this sort of harmonious integration also is an aspect of the contraction expansion of the hearts, drawing in, attracting in God's similarity. And he says that this is all of God's divine attributes and names. And then the expansion being that of the diffusion, the differentiation, incomparability of the transcendence, that there is nothing I can say or feel or think or do to express that at every instant, at the same time as at every instant it's in the now.
I really like what you're saying here, and I think it pertains directly to my question. You just explained it in very different words. And I think about this a lot, and I gave my talk at the SAND conference last year on this, if you want to look it up. But it has to do with, rather than polarizing to say everything is unmanifest or everything is manifest or nothing is real or everything is real or anything like that, or things are this way or things are that way, we expand the container, so to speak, so as to incorporate all these polarities and contradictions, apparent contradictions, and so on. And that is actually what God himself is the complete repository of all diversities and all that may be, all that is and all that is not, and so on. And if we aspire to the, you know, God realization, then we have to become that way, not just intellectually, but experientially as well. But it's conducive to that realization, I think, to kind of culture that way of thinking, where we can engulf or incorporate apparently contradictory opposites or polarities. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that what you were trying to say also?
Yeah, yeah. So like in a more practical sense, when you often, I hear this theme come up in a lot of spiritual conversations where you talk to the neo do-it-yourself sort of mentality. I'm already self-realized, I'm there.
Yeah, the world is an illusion, or yeah, it's just a conceptual overlay or something like that.
Yeah, I had an awakening. I spent whatever amount of years with whoever, wherever, and suddenly whatever happened, and now, you know, this has stayed with me, and okay, and so on. And then at the other end of the same spectrum, you have people that, you know, like, for instance, a lot of the traditional Qigong masters, because I studied Qigong, I studied various different forms of meditation. And I often talk about the Sufi sages because, in a sense, they were the first that kind of saved my life, even in childhood. So you can have, say, for instance, one person that gives you something or states a command of some sort, like you're healed or you're self-realized or you're this or that, whatever it is, some profound something. And this person says it to you, right? Now, given that that person, the question there is, given that that person has or does not have that is one question. The other is, on the other side, being the recipient of that, the seeker, what have you, what state that person is in, right?
What state the recipient is in?
Yeah. What kind of seeking love, sincerity, you know, seeking that. It can happen such that in a certain state, that when the master, let's just say in this case, it could be like a, think of it as a, you know, when we got our driving permit and then you had like a driving instructor, it could be as simple as that. It immediately translates. A driving instructor has driven for 20, 30 years, and he looks at the guy that's learning with him and he says, you're going to learn this in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, and the student is like, yeah, I'm going to learn this in 10 minutes. So he's not going to do it as good as the driving instructor, but right. He's going to do it. That's the kind of level of harmony and transmission that can happen. Or think of the total opposite of that. When it comes to spiritual realizations, it's much more delicate than that driving instructor and student because it's multiple levels and so on and so forth. You could extend it to multiple lifetimes or eons or whatever. If they're not in harmony, then imagine that this master could be Christ himself. And he says, you know, oh, you're going to learn this in 2 minutes. And like some of the disciples, you hear the stories. And the disciples like, oh, no way. You know, not even in 1,000 lives, it's not going to happen. And then this master says, oh, you think so? Okay, well, maybe...
Whatever you say.
I'll come back in 3 lifetimes and then we'll learn to drive or something. So there's a lot of that kind of dynamic at work in terms of this
sure.
type of manifest.
Well, Christ used a lot of metaphors like that. I mean, pearls before swine, and then the whole the parable of the sower where, you know, you throw the seeds on rocky soil or fertile soil, but it's very shallow, or, you know, various kinds of soils, and you get a completely different outcome in terms of what grows based upon the receptivity or fertility of the ground in which you throw the seeds. So there's always been that dynamic between teachers and students. And there's also a dynamic where, you know, a teacher can be quite incompetent, but the student is just so ardent and so sincere and so, you know, so ready to pop, so to speak, that the student makes great progress despite a very, you know, the bit questionable teacher, or even, you know, the student makes great progress revering a statue of a teacher, and because the student himself is just so ripe. Exactly. So there's all these different possibilities and dynamics.
And I think that relates back to what you were saying. I forgot the exact train of thought again, but before I said this, you were talking about how I translated it was in terms of how levels of manifest presence can be instant, or how they can be take so long for a person to receive or to be in that state.
Yeah, and there can also be both. I mean, you yourself, for instance, had a profound, rather instant breakthrough in that movie theater. But then, you know, 37 years later, you're still working on integrating and developing, you know, kind of, there's no end to it.
Yeah. In fact, that's so important you bring this up because, again, going back to the precursor to the greatest awakenings I've experienced, and I've come to this many times, is one time it happened so clearly to me is I would go on weekends to Yosemite National Park.
Mm-hmm.
This is in the earliest awakenings I had. And I would just get sort of like feverish and like sort of out of it. And I would just pick up my backpack and my mom would be worried about me because I was just my first year in the U.S. I was only 16 and a half, 17 then. I would say, I'm going away. You know, she'd be like, well, what do you mean? Where are you going and how long? And I'd be like, I don't know. Just give me a few days or something. And I just pack my bag and go to Yosemite. And often enough, actually, really funny things happen to me as well. It's like I thought I was going to go and just be out there, and then something very drastic would happen. Like I'd get poisoned head to toe, and then I had to come back home or something. It's like, but one of the very first things that happened, this was sort of an iconic moment for me, which which I think that if more spiritual seekers, and especially the so-called teachers and masters and gurus got, I think the world would be a much better place, which was that here I was, a young athlete, and my whole life, I have a gold medal in swimming, I have a silver, so my whole life I'd been this athlete. I mean, I'd get up really early, I'd play 12, 13 hours. That changed a lot when I moved to the U.S., but that's how fit I was. So I go to Yosemite, start hiking up Half Dome, which is one of the tough trails.
The back way.
Yeah, it's a steep. It's a very beautiful, but very steep, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'd have, 40, 50 pounds, and I started in the morning. Very quickly, I pass everybody going up. And so by the time you're about 2 miles up, you've pretty much passed everybody. It's early in the morning as well. And then this one time, this was one of the first times actually, when I was having a lot of back-to-back really bizarre phenomena without me actually really knowing what was happening. I was just in this very deep, earnest seeking state without actually even being able to verbalize it. This is when the near-death happened as well. This is also when I met some of the most powerful teachers, if you like, masters on the planet, so to speak. This was all a precursor to that. And I didn't even know the masters were great masters. I didn't know the experiences were great experiences. I was just in it. And one of the things was, on one of the earliest trips, all of a sudden, I just couldn't believe my eyes, because this is precisely what happened. So I'm going up pretty fast. And then I couldn't believe my eyes, because I saw this old man, 3 times faster than me, almost running up. I mean, these were like Stairmaster kind of steps.
Yeah, when you're going up half. Yeah, it's steep. They even have cables to hold on
exactly,
to, because it's
some
so steep.
You have to actually go up with cable.
Yeah.
And I saw this old man just going 3 times my speed, right past me. And this was early in the morning, so it meant that he had started later than me, way down at the bottom, at that speed, and he was well in advance ahead of me, and I still had 6 miles or 4 miles or something to go, because the total is about 7.5-8 miles. And I was like, wow, like, what just happened? Who is that? And I didn't think much about it other than, so it's just somebody super fit, right?
Yeah.
I think some of these events are actually spiritual phenomena, because now that I've come to accept the fuller possibility, I think it's very much possible that that was actual some kind of heavenly being, or maybe not human, who knows.
But could have been. I mean, were you thinking that you were pretty hot stuff passing all these people with a 50-pound pack, and then this guy zoomed past you? And
right, that's just how I lived, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was a pretty good athlete, and I wasn't thinking much about it, and I was in this just deep yearning and asking these deep questions, and I wanted to be alone, and I wanted to get away from everybody as soon as possible, to be alone. And here I was, going really fast and past everybody. And this guy came 3 times fast. I mean, he was literally jogging full speed all the way up the mountain. And I just couldn't believe it. And then by the time I was about halfway, he was jogging back down. Right? So he had finished the whole hike.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have probably taken the whole day if I could get to the end of it by the end of the day. That would have been good. And so that experience really remained with me as a theme for the rest of my spiritual life and practice, which was that if you really are genuinely on the right path, this is what I believe, this has been my experience. At every instant, the moment I think I have mastered something, or I know it, or I got it, someone like that shows up. Someone like that who's the least sort of candidate for that, an old man or a young kid, or, that's what I often say, a lot of times when I meet younger folks, and I say, I've been a student for 30 years, and I sort of challenge them that way. I say, I'm going to learn faster than you learn from me. You watch. I'm going to learn from you faster, or something like that, to where they immediately get into the mindset of, oh, this guy is really a student, because he really doesn't want to play master or the upper hand, or, because that's how God has dealt with me throughout my whole maturation.
It's a good point. A couple of people whom I respect a lot, Amma, the so-called hugging saint, and Adyashanti, they both are fond of saying it's always good to have the attitude of a beginner.
Yeah. Honestly, it feels like I haven't even started.
Yeah, exactly. I can relate to that. You know, relatively speaking, we probably haven't in terms of what's actually possible in terms of the span or the range of evolution that a soul is capable of undergoing. I think we're all relative beginners. At least I prefer to maintain that attitude.
Yeah. The divine has a way of, you know, again, I was speaking of Ibn Arabi. Ibn Arabi is a very interesting fellow for me because he inspired me since I was a teenager, his life, because he speaks of a lot of his personal awakenings. And one of his most profound experiences was when he was making his pilgrimage, because he was a pilgrim most of his life in his spiritual maturation. And when he was going to, in that particular culture, in the generally speaking, in the Sufi lineages, in the Sufi culture, the esoteric mystics of Islam, there is such level of humility that's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Which is very, I generally speaking, it's rare to find that much. You find it in other traditions as well, but in the Sufi path, it's just unbelievable because they, first of all, they speak of things that are just so hard to even believe that it's possible, but they're talking about it like it happens daily to them. But then, that aside, then all of a sudden, like Ibn Arabi says, when he went to the house of God, because he went to Mecca, one of his two greatest works, one is called Meccan Revelations, where he receives all these teachings in Mecca. It's a work that's 15,000 pages long. And he had a lot of theophanies and visitations during this time from the different prophets and sages. And just when he thought he had seen a lot of the prophets of our evolutionary cycle of the planet Earth, and now he was also receiving teachings from Adam, he suddenly realized there are many Adams. And then he was looking at Adam. This is the way he tells the story. He says, I was looking at Adam, and then I saw many more Adams. And I said, I thought Adam is the beginning of our race. Why are there so many Adams? And then Adam said to him, because in every evolutionary cycle, there is another Adam. So it's like, how much more of a capacity do you have to evolve? Because God will...
Well, you know, right now as you're speaking, in the background of my computer screen, I'm seeing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of galaxies because I have shots of galaxies from the Hubble Space Telescope as my screensaver, and it just keeps flashing my desktop pictures. And every one of those galaxies has perhaps 100 to 200 billion stars, and they keep increasing the number of estimated galaxies in the known universe. Now it's up around 2 trillion. And who knows how many universes there might actually be. And we know of our own galaxy that there are more planets in it than there are stars, because every star has, on average, at least one planet, and some of them have more. Just one more thing. On our own planet, we have what are called extremophiles, which are forms of life that live in boiling battery acid in volcanoes and at the bottom of oceans at thermal vents, you know, not only microscopic, but even big tube worms down there in the bottom of the ocean. So life emerges in the most inhospitable conditions that you can possibly imagine. And I suspect that that is true of the entire universe, that what we see out there in terms of the vast span of all these galaxies and stars is teeming with life of some sort or other. And much of this life, I think, has gotten very highly evolved. And you were speaking in the recording I heard about the Elohim, I believe, which are some kind of celestial beings whose wingspan, you know, spans vast distances and so on. I think that there are probably beings who have the jurisdiction of a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies or just some vast range of existence whose level of evolution is beyond our comprehension and whose level of power and influence is beyond our comprehension. So, you know, we're like little ants by comparison with some of the things, some of the life forms that must exist in this universe.
It's a very important point, especially if you think of it in the context of, like,
I mean,
you said, a lot of
the... sigh. I think that was because it was such a long, no, long riff. Okay. I went into. Whoa! Is he ever going to get to the end of that?
No, that's important. In terms of a lot of the mishap and controversies and all this that you also addressed a couple of times, I hear you talk about it in your other interviews a little bit too. A lot of this wouldn't even happen if a lot of these spiritual teachers and whatever their titles are understood and better grasped that we're just beginning. At any level we are, we're just beginning.
Yeah.
And, you know, the good news with that is that there would be so much room for them to receive correction, to also even have more, so much more power to help others.
Yes.
The only thing is that I think that the pop culture generally at any given time, mainstream pop culture, doesn't encourage that. What they encourage instead is, you know, you got to be a winner. You have to know what you're doing.
Instant results.
Yeah, good results, big results, fast results, big numbers. Look good on camera, you know. Donate millions of dollars. I have all these basically like really amazing resume, you know, to be considered, you know, success, great teacher.
You know? Well, you know, a while back we were talking about the importance of discrimination, and I said maybe that's the most important quality, but maybe humility is an even more important quality, or at least those two together are a good safeguard, you know, two wheels of the evolutionary bicycle that you want to have properly inflated. Before we run out of time, I want to ask you some other questions that people sent in. Do you want to comment on what we've just been discussing before I ask those?
No, I just want to say that on that note that you're speaking, when the 12 years later, when I speak of the other awakening 10 to 10,000 times more powerful, was actually in the presence of Christ.
Oh, you had like a theophany. Was it that word, theophany?
Yeah, theophany.
Yeah. So there was a describe it a
bit. This one was the near death experience, 10 to 10,000 times more intense. It was all night. Started sometime past midnight, went all the way till dawn. And on this subject of the archangels and, you know, the Holy Spirit and the Elohim and those types of forces. This is why I believe a lot of people, again, along the same line, they're really mistaken to try to give a linear narrative. Because I hear a lot of people say, oh, the Elohim or this or that, or they some entity went to war with some other entity, or some two entities mated together and created this other entity, and the Elohim is this one and the other one is that. And then and there's a lot of that kind of conversation. The galaxy is teeming with so many billions. And I mean, what is it in the ocean alone? They say, I don't remember, but I was seeing documentaries of just how beautiful and vast the ocean is. And they were saying that even the deepest divers that could go, now we could go really deep into the ocean, they estimate that there's at least 60,000 or more, or 100 some thousand or more species in the ocean that we still don't even know.
Oh yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of them are dying because of us, but there's a lot of stuff that we don't know, even at the very greatest depths of the Marianas Trench and places like that.
So point being that there are great forces, but we should never think that we could kind of put them together like that in this sort of linear, this one and that one. And
yeah, we're kind of applying our limited human understanding to how they might operate, but they probably operate in ways that are far beyond our ability to conceive. Okay, let me ask you a few of these questions. This one is from Marty Kraft in Kansas City, Missouri, who asks, I condensed his question a little bit. Please speak about the importance of speaking about presence based upon direct experience rather than just intellectual understanding.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. I think Marty also connected with me on Facebook. I appreciate it. Thank you for your positive. He has this supportive presence. Thank you. Like a lot of what we've been saying, or a lot of what I've been saying, occasionally people will say to me, are these intellectual types of things that we're talking about, especially when I'm a little more reserved to talk about my personal experiences. As I said, because this is such a large platform and we're speaking to such a large group, I think I feel that it's important to remain within a larger container, so to speak. If you and I were to have phone conversations, or if you were to write to me or whatever, my friends or my spiritual teachers from way back would also say, to a fault, I'm like an open book. So I actually don't have much reservation. I just open up, I talk about experiences. But I don't feel, I look at it more in terms of why you're saying what you're saying, to whom you're saying it, where it's coming from. And then according to that, yes, experiences come into play, but the wider the audience, the wider the container, I think experiences need to be embracing, sort of like a big ship, if you will. So it's like...
people can relate to it. But yeah. I think his main point is how it's important to walk your talk, to actually be experiencing stuff that you're expounding and not having it just be ideas that you have perhaps mistaken for an experience. What very often happens, and often in Neo-Advaita circles, is that people dwell on these concepts a lot, reading the various books and so on, and they end up mistaking an intellectual understanding for realization. It's easy to do that because the knowledge is so profound that it elevates us when we put our attention on it. You know, we feel like, oh yes, I have a whiff of that unity that they're speaking about. But if you could somehow step into Ramana Maharshi's sandals for a minute, you might find that, oh, that is really different than what I had thought was realization. It's much more profound.
Yeah, actually, read this question again. That way, with your feedback, I can hear it again.
Well, I did edit his question down, but I said, please speak about the importance of speaking about presence based upon your direct experience, your own experience, rather than just speaking about it on the basis of intellectual understanding.
In light of what you also said now, thank you for that as well. I think it's very important, actually, to come from experience from moment to moment. Again, one of the most famous sayings of Lord Ali is that experience is your greatest teacher. Again, on this subject of masters and teachers and great beings and whatnot, the way that I've received the teachings, it's never been about worshiping someone or something, an entity or a guru or an idol or anything. I've had this way of presence coming to me, hosting presence. It has a lot to do with attention. In my meditations, in my audio meditations on my Facebook, what comes through a lot is some of the basic levels of beginning meditation has to do with noticing, sensing, attending, intending. So those are some of the basic. A lot of that fits into the larger context of I am that I am. And that, a lot of that fits into the context of even from the very moment, that whatever moment I'm in, itself is an experience of presence, you know? And so I would say presence is your greatest teacher, experience is your greatest teacher. And this one time we were seated with a group of people that now I'm speaking more from experience. I've often struggled with people who are followers. I often say follower, don't fall lower.
Don't fall lower, in case people didn't catch that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's some archetypal thing going on with followers. A lot of times, troubling stuff. You hear a lot of stories.
Again, it depends upon how you approach it, whether you abdicate your common sense and follow somebody. You know, you're hoping to hitch your wagon to a star, and it turns out to be a falling star rather than a shooting star. you know, and there have been so many cases where people have gotten way, way, way off the deep end following somebody who just got crazier and crazier. I mean, Jonestown is one of the worst examples. Or whether you have a wholesome teacher in a wholesome situation, and you surrender, you know, a good deal of your autonomy in order to actually be receptive to what the teacher has to say and not blocking it out with your own opinions all the time.
Exactly. And in this group we were sitting in, there were a wide range of the good and sort of like the really, it was interesting. And we were having dialogues and we're talking. And then we got into this space of silence where we were just sitting in silence for a while. And a very profound thing came to me that was that the master is the truth of the moment. And so I sort of contemplated that because it was a powerful, you know, a lot of times when these things happen, it comes with a lot of, that's why I often say when we meditate, pray together, it's a communion. To me, it's not an exchange of information or an informative type of thing, although it has those layers. But to me, it's more about the way we are now hosting presence and every now moment. And when this came, that the master is the truth of the moment, it put so many things into perspective, not just for me, but a lot happened there, even physically, in bodies, in the physical body, in the emotional body. So I would also say that in light of that subject.
Let me ask another question. This is from Wesley Morton in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Do you have any thoughts, experiences on lucid dreaming? Following a strong awakening last year, these past months, I have experienced lucid dreaming with some regularity. The lucid dream state is responsive to requests and intentions. It has brought a deep healing and release. The dream entities seem to be autonomous. They offer interesting and surprising insights and guidance. Many dream experiences sound parallel to the NDE you describe. Any thoughts?
So there's different levels of that. So one of the basic things that I often say in terms of, I also think of it more in terms of like angelology 101, is if you don't study it side by side with Satanology, or a more friendly term would be daemonology, not demonology, but daemonology, because daemon is actually the more appropriate term that was used before the word demon, because demon is generally referring to very negative entity type things. But Satan and Satanology in ancient times was more of a study of any form of adversary, as well as other beings that were more benign. And daemons were beings like Socrates had a daemon.
Like a muse that poets or musicians might have, huh?
Yeah, and in Socrates' case, it was a very special case because this daemon, you hear this also about the jinn in the Muslim culture.
So it's like a guardian angel or a guiding angel.
Yeah. The jinn can be mighty, very mighty and powerful beings. They could be from the very positive side of the spectrum all the way to the very negative. And the daemons are similar. And then later on, you know, like modern theology has gone through so many rationalistic and materialistic concepts, which have turned into just mental stuff. But ancient, when you go back to early beginnings of Kabbalah or Judaism, Christianity, Islam, there was a much wider range of understanding of a lot of different kinds of beings and whatnot. So I would say that one of the first cautionary things that I often tell people, which most often, especially younger, inexperienced, I don't know who your questioner is, but I'm just saying this is not personally to him, but often they don't listen. But this is what I say, is that if you want to study dreams, or if you want to go into any altered state, because there's a fascination with altered states, do it cautiously, carefully, and don't only think that you're going on the positive end. You're just having a good love and light trip, or you're having dreams and they're just all good dreams. Because if you don't side by side understand this dynamic, this dance. So that's the first thing I would say, is if you're doing dream work, study, or angelology, make sure you're studying the full spectrum.
So you know what you're dealing with.
Yeah. Any form of altered state, you know, hypnosis, past life regression,
psychedelics,
lucid dreaming.
Channeling.
Channeling. I had to dabble in channeling and mediumship stuff in my pilgrimages for about 7-8 years. That was quite an intense trip as well. So I would say that. I'd say a lot of people in spirituality also often say, oh, I've mostly had good experiences, or, you know, I only talk to the angels. And then often you find out further down the line, they suddenly tripped over to the other side. Like they were new ages and suddenly they became religious again. Like, whoa, what happened? And they say, oh, I thought I was channeling good entities, but they were all demons. Now I realize I need to go back to Christ or something. This flipping sides, right to left, right, is because right from the start, they didn't have this discernment of a fuller spectrum. And those are the ones most dangerous in terms of teachers as well.
Yeah. Well, they do say that, you know, there are astral entities who might masquerade as being gurus or light beings or whatever, but they actually have a malicious, malevolent intent.
I can't even tell you how many really bizarre circumstances I've been in with even very so-called advanced authors, teachers, healers. There's a whole field called spirit releasement that has to do with various phenomena and levels of spirits. There's a great guy, he's a spiritual guy. His name is Anthony William. I like him. He talks about the spiritual dimensions of illnesses and sicknesses. And he gives a lot freely. If you guys, whoever is listening, you know, watch him, listen to him. His books are just packed with so much really amazing information. But he's a good example of what he's doing is revolutionary in the sense that, for instance, spirit has guided him from age 4 or 5 or something, where he can identify from a range of some 60 different varieties of a particular virus. The medical system has only, say, learned of 2 of them, like, let's say, Epstein-Barr. So one of the things he talks about is actually the number one killer isn't really heart disease. Heart disease is in the extreme case the number one killer. The number one killer is all the symptoms everybody's having, which they don't know what they are.
How does this relate to what we've been talking
about? Yeah, exactly. In the spiritual sense, when you go into altered state and lucid dreams and all that sort of stuff, you're in a vast, more dynamic, more alive, more populated dimension of diverse beings and creatures and symbols and entities and on and on. So you got to go cautiously, carefully, hopefully with really good research so that you have really good resources at your fingertips. And hopefully you're sincere enough that you attract really good teachers as well.
Yeah, there's an old analogy, which is, let's say there's a territory. And the territory has all kinds of things in it that you could explore, you know, diamond mines and gold mines and fascinating things here and interesting things there. And you start exploring. But the trouble is, you don't own the territory. There's a fort that's in the center of it that commands the whole territory. The priority should be to capture the fort. And then once you've captured the fort, then you can more safely and at your leisure explore all these possibilities. Until then, it could be a dangerous enterprise.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. And also for that, having proper guidance and what that means. Every time I come upon any phenomenon that I'm studying, with lucid dreams, for instance, there are different levels. We could get into that maybe another time. But basically, one basic beginning step that's very helpful is to let it be, let it come, let it stay, let it go, and just chronicle them. So whether it's in a tape recorder or like I do a shorthand, sometimes I just, even if it's an intense one, I let go of my analytic brain trying to understand it because it happens at a different level, you know, so I just chronicle it. Yeah, that's an important one. The other important thing, bringing up spirit releasement, Anthony Williams and diseases, is because more and more what we're finding is that the spiritual dimensions of any sort of disease. Yeah, in fact, you might want to talk to Anthony.
Yeah, I'm just jotting it down.
On the show. I especially love to talk about guys like Bruno Gröning and Anthony William and those like him that give so much freely. So in terms of spiritual forces, there are so many more. In spirit releasement, what the researchers found, some of the practitioners of spirit releasement were called in by some of the greatest, most advanced Zen masters. And the reason was the Zen masters were saying, we can see how powerful this is. And this was founded by a guy who was a very spiritual, esoteric kind of Christian fellow, that there are so many ranges and varieties and that most people, even the healthiest people, have more than 80%, I think what they did samplings and what they found is more than 8. I would say, from my experience, I would say almost everybody has a variety of spiritual forces of different kinds, of strains of different kinds.
That are sort of lodged in their yeah. systems or their psyches and are having an influence on their life, perhaps a binding
exactly.
influence.
Exactly.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I've experienced and releasing like some of those things in my life, you know, quite vividly.
And a whole range. So it goes also with dreams, especially, as well as with altered states. that's what you start to get into. You start to dabble into that spectrum of, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a big topic. Let me ask you one final question and then we'll wrap it up. This is Akshay from Pune, India. He asks, if one manages to be in sync with the present moment all of the time, is that a spiritual practice? Can this practice transform a human being?
So many buzzwords in there.
I know.
So I would say present moment awareness and meditation, it can turn into a lot of cliche type of mental.
Can it end up being kind of manipulative where you're losing the spontaneity of awareness in daily, spontaneity of behavior in daily activity because you're trying to do things while maintaining present moment awareness?
Yeah, it needs to be, like earlier we touched on it a little bit, the practice of presence or being present, it's also very precise. It also has many levels, layers, experiences, stations, stages, states. It's delicate. So for me, how I can say a couple of things about how it was for me, I often speak in terms of a spectrum, if you notice. In terms of a spectrum, the spiritual path and the practice of presence and meditation, I see it on the one hand as something that needs to be most you, meaning the most effortless, just you being you. So don't try to be present, don't try to meditate, don't try, you know, learn first that very initial, you said beginning mind. I sometimes refer to it as the pre-learning stages of cognition. Pre-learning in the sense that, you know, like moment to moment, there is an instant kind of connection that happens, like right now. Then there's a sort of a processing that follows it. But that instant of that moment that, again, the master is the truth of the moment, that instant of the connectivity of the moment and heart to heart, soul to soul, being to being happens. And then there's all this processing that happens. You know, that is the pre-learning stage. It's also the pre-learning stages of listening, pre-learning stages of speaking. That's why when they do this self-inquiry, like in the Maharishi tradition of who am I? For me, it was more like who and what's God all about? You know, that's how it began. Not so much the word G-O-D. So presence for me started as an inquiry into who and what is beyond all this or in all this that I don't understand. I would say that that is very important. So it's a full spectrum. There's the effortlessness on the one end. On the other end, it's the hardest, most difficult, and even maybe nearly impossible practice that you must earn, harder than the greatest world athlete putting his life on the line every day. It's both.
Yeah. One of those paradoxes again. Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like we just scratched the surface. Yeah. We could probably go on for days and keep getting into different things, and hopefully we'll have another opportunity. There isn't much on your website, and there isn't much about you on the internet. So if people are intrigued by what you had to say, how can they interact with you more, or learn more, or read more?
I would periodically interact with you guys. Because I learned this with the previous YouTube interview, when people commented and asked questions where I feel guided and where I feel I can have an input, I will respond in the comment section of this interview.
Okay, so the way we do comments is we don't do them on YouTube, but we have a Facebook group, and I set up a new thread for each interview, and sometimes that results in hundreds of comments and discussions. And then I link to that Facebook thread from the description on YouTube and on the page on BatGap that will be dedicated to this interview. So, you know, people will get going and they'll start discussing. You could come in there and respond to anything you feel like you'd like to respond to.
Okay. Another thing is I sometimes occasionally do these Facebook meditations, audio meditations.
Okay. How do you let people know about that?
If they're on Facebook, they'll see it.
I see. They can subscribe to your Facebook page tune into it. Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah. They're just all freely given. And at one time, I was being approached by publishers to publish some of my blogs that had over 100,000 readers. I think that by the time you got a hold of me, I had taken them all down.
Yeah, there wasn't much there.
yeah, and now I have mostly just a few academic papers. But I started this project that sort of serves as a container also for this interview, and I just started it recently. It's not so much a project. It's, again, a certain way of hosting presence that will address a lot of different topics in a work that hopefully I'll find the right publishers as well. I've wanted the teaming together of the right forces for me to publish or do a video. I've been approached to do documentaries and to publish. But I often end up speaking more reverently of others' works, and I usually take down whatever little I have. But I will have the one called I Ask My Soul, Who Am I?
That's something you've written?
It would be a container and a sort of an updated, I call it a more honest, bold way of addressing everything I'd written before because it was too much stuff.
Yeah.
So I took it all down to rebuild and summarize everything in a new, simple way. So
well, I'll link to your website from Backyap. Do you ever have little meetings in person, like out in the Bay Area or anything like that? Have any desire to do that?
People can write to me and I'll feel it out.
Usually they can email you through your website. Is that it?
No, actually my email is not on the website, but on
Facebook.
Facebook, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
My website is being built. Again, even the whole idea of a website, I've never been crazy because I'm not selling anything. I've never been.
Well, I'll link to your website and your Facebook page. And there isn't too much on your website at the moment, but it sounds like your Facebook page is the main thing.
On my website, I will post more writings to come.
Okay, good.
One of them will be, I Ask My Soul, Who Am I?
Okay. You know what you might want to do is you might want to collect email addresses on your website so people can be notified whenever you do post something, through MailChimp or one of those programs. It's easy to collect email addresses.
Okay. And if people who are really interested, if they would help me out, it's because I have a limited time. So they can just be on my Facebook and then they can always see what I'm posting new.
All right. Well, thanks. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you as well.
Very
hopefully to be continued. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah, you bet.
And I'd like to come see you guys someday. Hopefully I'll get a chance. You're not too far from me, I think.
Well, we're in Iowa. You're in San Francisco.
Oh, but... no, Iowa.
Yeah. Okay.
I thought you were in Fairfield, California.
Oh, no. I grew up in Fairfield, Connecticut. Now I live in Fairfield, Iowa. Okay. Maybe before I die, I'll move to Fairfield, California.
So you've been to Fairfield, Connecticut and Iowa.
Yeah, okay, that's where I grew up in Fairfield, Connecticut. But I come out to California every fall for the Science and Non-Duality Conference. Maybe I'll see you at one of those or something.
Yeah, yeah. Wonderful. I've been told to participate in the IANS in California as well. We'll see.
Yeah, well, we'll be in touch. I'm going to stay in touch with you. Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and thanks to those who've been listening or watching. As you know, this is an ongoing series. Next week, I'll be talking with Peter Mount Shasta, and we're going to be talking about some of the things that Hooman and I talked about today. He's a very interesting guy, so stay tuned for that. Come to backgap.com if you wish, and there's several things you could do there. Sign up for email notification of new interviews. Sign up for the audio podcast if you want to. Check out the past interviews and upcoming interviews menus. Make a donation if you wish to. And a few other things if you explore the menus.
Yeah, you didn't start with that. When you say you thank the appreciative listeners and all that.
Yeah,
I think when you started, you did?
I mentioned that at the beginning.
Okay, good.
We always want to be easygoing about that, not create barriers for entry or start twisting people's arms or anything. It's just like, if you feel inspired, then great.
Yeah, well, I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
And thanks again to those who've been listening or watching, and we'll see you next time.